When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You are listening to the Next Best Picture podcast, and these are Dan Baer's interviews with the director, writer, and star for the film Stress Positions, Dada Hamill, and the film's star and producer, John Early.
I couldn't find my wallet.
Hi, Leo.
When do I get to meet him?
Who?
The model.
He's my nephew, and he's very badly injured.
Well, what did he look like? Did he have a nice ass?
Terry wouldn't let us meet Balul, the 19-year-old male model from Morocco with a badly broken leg. Who was he, that poor boy in the basement?
What in the name of God?
Hi, Uncle Terry.
Well, should you put on a shirt?
Why?
Aren't you cold?
No.
Strong chi.
What is so exciting about models?
First of all, they're very attractive. You know, I read that in Morocco, people eat with their hands.
We're eating with our hands.
Not hamburgers. Tajine.
Sure.
Welcome, everyone, to the Next Best Picture podcast, where we are talking with John Early, the star and producer of the new film Stress Positions. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. I wanted to start by asking what... kind of an obvious question, but I feel like it gives important context, which is, how did you get involved in this project?
Well, Theda Hamill, the writer, director, editor, composer, and star of this movie, is an old friend of mine. We met at Atlantic Acting School, where I was working the front desk after completing my training there, and Theda was beginning hers. We just immediately were very drawn to each other. I think we immediately recognized a kind of, you know, probably like pretentious self-seriousness, but also a kind of irreverent subversiveness too in each other. And we, you know, we worked on like this Brecht play together. She was the assistant director and I was playing the snare drum in a Henley.
Very nice.
Yes. And I think it was really that process where we really kind of merged and understood how funny the other person was, you know, because we were in a very kind of serious, like, milieu, you know, at that time.
Brecht.
Brecht.
Very serious.
We were at Atlantic, it was David Mamet, it was, you know, and then we just became very, very good friends, and I think kind of somewhat shared a worldview, or even kind of developed one together as friends do. And then I hosted this variety show called Showgasm. I didn't come up with the name, at Ars Nova for 5 years in Midtown. And these are really like the happiest years of my life. And Theda was my DJ sidekick co-host. And we would just talk endlessly on stage together, pretty drunk. And it's like the most fun I've ever had as a performer. But it was kind of in that I learned that Theda had this like really unique ability as far as like my experience in this industry goes, like to take my silliness and to locate the kind of deeper critique inside of it, like underneath it, and kind of tease that out and help people see it. And I think that's precisely what she did with this movie. We also worked on a Wallace Shawn play together in 2018, you know, and I think that's also where we got a little more serious as collaborators. We were like, went from being like kind of on stage, a little on stage duo to like, we're like kind of getting back to our roots theatrically. And anyway, but she wrote me this movie that I thought it took this like kind of comedy thing that I already did and found like a sadness in it. It located it in a very specific moment in time and gave this character a very specific history. And it was a dream. It was a dream.
I love that, you know, you sort of found each other, not even as classmates, but at theater school. Old theater kid, like, I love this so much. And those connections really do, like, when you find someone who speaks to your artistic self, they really just, they bond you for life. It's incredible.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned that this is, you know, sort of this comedy thing that you kind of already did, but there's a lot of layers to it and this sadness. One of the things that really struck me about poor Terry is that, you know, he's obviously dealing with a lot of history with not feeling wanted by his sister, by his soon-to-be ex-husband. And yet, you know, we're in this moment where he's thrust together with this nephew. And do you think that he, and that we, like, particularly as gay people, often conflate being wanted and being needed? Because I feel like that was this tension between him in taking care of Baklul in this movie.
Okay. You've gone there. I have gone there.
Look, we're both gay men of a certain age. These are the sorts of things that are on the mind.
Yes. Well, the needed part of it is very interesting to me, because that's something that I, as a kind of recovering Presbyterian, like from the South, that's a world where you establish your value in the eyes of others is like your kind of your ability to answer other people's needs, you know, and that can come from a really earnest place in Christianity, like, you know, helping the poor. But then it can also be, it can be exploited, or it can be like, it can become kind of pathological and not helpful. I think that Terry really over-identifies with this sense of like charity and like kind of suffering for like on behalf of others. And he's always just, he's always feeling very put upon. I think if he were to remove that feeling, he would not have anything, especially because I think, as you're kind of also saying, especially as his like kind of gay identity, his like even former twink identity, which is maybe not clear in the movie, but it was certainly in like me and Theta's kind of history of Terry thing. We were like, he was a twink, you know, who was kind of kept by this like depraved older man because he was a twink. And then he aged out of that archetype and then was like dropped on his ass. Yeah. So I don't know. He's certainly not wanted and he's not needed. I'm not sure how those things are conflated, but like he's lost both. But I think that, I think what he's trying to do in the movie is like proof, like even if he fails miserably at this, but he's like trying to show how kind of like invaluable he is as a caretaker, you know, to Baklul and to his friends and stuff. And I don't know, it doesn't work.
One of my favorite little design choices in the movie is that whiteboard that at one point says, "Learn to cook." And cook is in all caps and underlined.
Yes.
A question mark. And some names of like cookbooks or cooks.
I think the question mark is actually after Allison Roman.
Yeah, Allison Roman, yes. Which is, it's the most New York thing.
Yes.
I loved it because it instantly took me, like a lot of the movie does, but it took me right back to 2020 and like, oh my God, we have to fend for ourselves with the food here. So I'm wondering, what was your favorite recipe that you learned to cook during the lockdown period?
God. I actually think I know, because there was a lot. To be clear, like Theta wrote this for me, like she was using a lot of my kind of particular quirks and like perverting them and, you know, deepening them. And one of them is my like kind of tortured relationship to cooking. I don't know. But at that time, the one I made, there was a crispy, and it's always crispy in the title. I'm like, why has it got to be crispy? I'm glad it's crispy texturally. Like,
sure, yes.
Right. Anyway, there's a Molly Baz Bon Appetit recipe that is these crispy smashed potatoes that are like with a like walnut anchovy, like Aleppo chili pepper sauce and like dill and labneh or sour cream underneath.
Wow.
They are sensational.
Okay, I'm going to have to find that recipe because that sounds delicious.
Crispy smashed potatoes, Molly Baz. Look that up.
I will.
But honey, do not go blindly into the salt proportion.
Oh, no, you have to.
There's Simon Kosher and there's Morton. Okay. Mm-hmm. They were actually require vastly different measurements, and you will ruin your potatoes if they're under or over seasoned. So really do your research. Thank you.
Ruth, always. Oh my gosh, my own tortured relationship to cooking. We're not here to talk about that. No. We are here to talk about, you know, this movie. There's so much chaos happening everywhere at all times. And did that vibe carry over to the set, to like from the characters to the real people living it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a weird, well, first of all, I've never had a non-chaotic like filming experience.
You're always
squeezed on a scheduling level. Everyone's always totally exhausted. It's like, you get on a train on day one and you do not get off for like 3 or 4 weeks. And it's terrifying, you know, and you lose all semblance of like control over yourself, you know, like it's crazy. Like it was crazy, but I also think one of my favorite things about like making art, even though it's also one of the most terrifying things about making art, is there is always this weird conversation between the real life, your real life, and what the art you're making. And like the art absorbs stuff from the real life, and your real life absorbs stuff from the art. And like, you know, there was some of that was conscious, like Theta using my own like kind of relationship to my back. Like I've had like several back surgeries, and like and one of my back surgeries delayed this movie.
Oh no.
So like, you know, there was like a lot of, there was that, you know, but then on a kind of more deeper, more mysterious level, there is just like, Kahir is an actual model, and is this like bright angel. Everyone on set was like totally enamored with this like sweet kind of just angel, you know, and then I'm over here being like, guys, we gotta go. I was like, is this happening? Am I jealous? You know, like it's so funny. But yeah, there was like I think a kind of natural kind of chaos. But then there was also like, this was a really ambitious movie formally. And Theta was coming to this with, she's a real cinephile. She had a lot of very big kind of theoretical ideas about like the camera and like how we were going to shoot this. And like, when you're dealing with like a kind of really fast, kind of low budget shoot, it's really, really easy to fall back on kind of convention and a kind of like Brooklyn indie kind of mumblecore, like straightforward kind of shooting. And I think Theta wanted to do something more elevated and experimental. And so I think a lot of what made this a challenging shoot, but in the best way, was like with the time we had, which was very little, trying to let Theta, this first time filmmaker, like really like go there. And like, she really did. I'm really, really proud of her. Like she's doing some like audacious things in this movie. And I think it has a real style and panache.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Coming up on the end of our time together, unfortunately.
Oh.
But I say no too, but schedules. I did want to ask, because you are such a iconic New York, Manhattan, Brooklynite character now twice over, that I have to ask, if Elliot from Search Party ever ended up at the party house in stress positions, what do you think he would say to Terry?
I think Elliot, like for all of his flaws, is actually more integrated than Terry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's in acceptance of his, he's long, long ago embraced the fact that he's like a pathological liar, you know, that he's like a grifter. He's open about those things. He knows those things about himself, which, you know, as despicable as he was, he could at least relax a little bit because he knew that about himself. And I think Terry is so profoundly in denial, and it leads to a lot of back pain. And I think that, I think Elliot probably wouldn't even waste any time talking to Terry, but if he was forced to, I think he would probably just kind of tell him to relax.
He needs to relax.
He really needs to relax. Not just for himself, for everyone around him.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, John, thank you so much. It's been a delight.
Thank you. I love the star background.
Thank you. Yeah. Have a great one. Thanks so much.
To all of our listeners of the Next Best Picture podcast, we know you love movies. We do too. Do you like going to the theater? Well, Regal Unlimited just makes sense. Regal Unlimited is the all-you-can-watch movie subscription pass that pays for itself in just 2 visits. See any standard 2D movie anytime with no blackout dates or restrictions. When you want to watch a movie in a premium format like 4DX, IMAX, RPX, or ScreenX, your Regal Unlimited membership gets you into those premium experiences at a reduced cost. And with Regal Unlimited, you won't just save money on tickets, you'll also save on snacks. Members get 10% off on all non-alcoholic concession items. So if you're planning to see 2 movies this month, just 2, you need to join Regal Unlimited. Sign up now in the Regal app or on regmovies.com/unlimited. That's regmovies.com/limited. And you can tell them Next Best Picture sent you with the promo code /RegalNBP24. That's /RegalNBP24.
Welcome, everyone, to the Next Best Picture podcast, where we are talking with Theda Hamill, the writer, director, and co-star of Stress Positions. Theda, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Dan. It's my pleasure. It's great to talk to you.
Very excited to talk to you about this movie because it opens with, an all-timer of a first line, which is, "I want to talk." Which is how all the best conversations always start, right? Like, it always feels like that's like when you find out you're getting fired or that your partner wants to break up with you.
It's bad news when somebody says that.
It's always bad news when someone wants to say that. So I was just like, when you were sitting down to write this, what did you most want to talk about?
That's a really good question. I guess that I just wanted to speak to a weird, very difficult to reconcile experience of living through that moment in time or being at a certain age. But more than that, I wanted to see John play this character, basically. I wanted to see him play this poor guy, Terry Goon, in all his splendor and abjection. And that was my main intention.
It is very fun to watch John Early take a pratfall. It's the best. It's so funny because, like, this poor guy, it's kind of like the Sisyphean task of trying to clean up this house and take care of all these people who could not care less about any
of
that. It felt very Buñuel, like the street charm of the bourgeoisie, endlessly preparing for, you know, a dinner party that just doesn't happen sort of thing. Like, it also reminded me of Mother, the Darren Aronofsky film. Was the sink braced?
No, I haven't seen it.
it's just constantly the worst party and the worst people keep coming in and destroying this poor girl's house.
It is a lot like directing a movie.
And it was just, when you're thinking about where did these characters and this location come from? Because obviously, like, you know, like, we've all lived through the pandemic. I think it's something that it's quite easily understandable, someone wanting to tell a story about that. But where did these characters and this incredible party house come from?
Well, the party house came late. The first idea was the character, and then the idea was that the character would be surrounded by his opposites. So just like you say, like, the character, he's like a Sisyphus, like, pushing the smallest rock up the smallest hill and failing. Like, he can't cook. You know, it's not about, like, I can't cure cancer. He can't cook a meal. He can't throw a dinner party. He can't make a speech. He can't take care of his nephew. Like, he can't do anything. And rather than going, I don't care, you know, to hell with it, that's just not my thing, the character instead is like going, I'm going to go crazy. Why can't I do any of this? It's like it's the most serious thing for him that he can't make any of this work. And like, so that character, it was just going to be surrounded by the people who were antithetical to that. Like, you know, Bahlul being the big one, his nephew, But Carla, the character that I play, also being one. And that all had to happen somewhere. Originally, it was like a big house. It was like an Airbnb house, almost. Like a very tacky millennial Airbnb house. That house fell through. This was before we even got financing. So then I thought, well, just find a dump. Like, just find some dump, like, undecorated, unrenovated. And we'll just call it a party house. And the idea is that this ex-husband, rather than renting it out as an Airbnb, he would throw orgies there, basically.
Of course.
As
you do.
For parties. we've all been there. And that this would be the ruin where this guy would be trapped in. And it kind of is nice for a COVID set movie to have somebody actually drowning in space, like a very spacious, ruinous house, rather than cramped in a stupid apartment, which is more the Carla character is doing something more like what I experienced, you know, being, she was in Greenpoint and in a railroad. So
it's just,
I think
so
that's
much
how
fun.
We got to the party house. And we found it very much at the last minute. It was like maybe two, three weeks before shooting started.
And that was going to be my next question, is if you had shot everything on location or if any of it was a set.
None of it was a set. I would have loved to experiment a little bit with a set, but the house really was like our soundstage, basically. And I loved that because it's very, I like the idea, like from the theater, of just like showing up to a theater every day for work. It's a very comforting feeling.
Yeah.
But I think the crew maybe drove them a little crazy to keep lighting these same rooms and do the same halls, running cables through the same halls. But no, that was our home base. And the production office was on the top floor.
Perfect.
Top floor, production, next floor, Coco, next floor, Terry, next floor, Bahul. So.
I love that. The production design, how much fun did you have, like, just getting all this stuff to fit in this house? Because like the giant disco ball, the whiteboard that says learn to cook on it.
Oh yeah, learn to cook. That's a little Easter egg there. Learn to cook. It says learn to cook Allison Roman ? So all of this Bon Appetit Allison Roman stuff on those whiteboards.
So how much fun did you have like coming up with stuff to put into this space? How did you determine the personality of it?
I had no fun. I hated
no
it.
Fun.
I thought it was terrible. I had no fun. And I think that our production designer, Gordon Landeberger, who also appears, like we had I won't speak too much about it, but like there was a sort of art crisis really early on before we started shooting where we're like, oh my God, we have nothing. We have none of what we need. So our production designer, Gordon Landeberger, came in at the last minute, flew in from LA, and basically was pulling everything together like through just sheer force of will the whole month that we were there. And he actually plays the character, sort of down on his luck character out on the street, this sort of eccentric man on the street. That is our production designer at the very last day of shooting. So it's very unexaggerated. Like that is the state that I think he felt he was in by the end of it. But he did an amazing job with very little preparation and very, very few resources. So I'm more grateful to him for going through all of that than anything.
I wonder if somehow, like, you know, you think about like, you know, cosmic things that are happening. And I wonder if that was like how it was supposed to happen, because this is such a chaotic movie and this space is, you know, also chaotic with not just in the history that it was used for, but with people constantly coming and going and all the action.
Yeah, well, there's something very, I guess like that it's a truism, but like the circumstances of the movie propagate themselves into the circumstances of the production and vice versa. And the fact that we were always at the end of our rope, that we were patching things together in a very threadbare way. You know, the reason that Terry's sink doesn't ever turn on in the kitchen is because it's not plugged into the wall. There is no pipe in that room. We cut the sink out of the basement and moved it up the stairs and put it there, and the faucet doesn't work. So in a weird way, the fact that we don't have a working sink and the fact that Terry doesn't have a working sink is the same thing. And the camera is just capturing the literal fact of the stress that we were all under. So I think that I actually think that it does imprint on the movie in a way that I like. There's a sort of nice, threadbare, desperate quality to the world of the movie that enhances the fiction of it for me.
Absolutely. You know, like all this, you know, talking about all the chaos and the energy of this movie, of everything that's happening, then thinking back to the COVID lockdown times, do you think that pandemic-induced isolation is still screwing around with our heads and how we interact with people?
Yes, because I actually think that what the pandemic did was it ushered in an era of virtuality and confusion that was already nascent, that was like all of the technologies were already in place, and COVID allowed them to really take over and dominate. And like, you know, that's not exactly true. I've had very few in-person meetings with anyone, like relating to the movie or the business or anything like that, even press, that weren't on Zoom. Like Zoom really took over all of life. It almost feels like COVID was just an accelerant of those tendencies it's not like we're living in the trauma of COVID. We're living in the world that was being designed for us in advance of COVID, this weird world of virtuality and liquid persona and social media confusion, all that kind of stuff. We're just like drowning a little bit more in it now. I don't know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there is another line that struck me in the movie when it's near the end and it's, you know, why should I be this person? Why can't I be someone else? Yeah, I mean, why can't we all be someone else? But then thinking about that time and specifically this movie, I sometimes wonder if we trap ourselves into who we are just as much, if not more so, than like societal expectations and pressures do.
Yeah, I think that there's a tension that I feel very acutely and I think is in the movie of just like two contradictory things. One is that we're very aware of the difference between ourselves and others, and we're actually encouraged to really draw that line in a very bold way. Say, this is what I am, and this is what I am not, and there is no crossing that chasm. On the other hand, we're really encouraged to believe in our own transformation, and even transition, like gender transition of the kind that I've gone through in my life, is a testament to the fact that you can change in a pretty serious way. You can, something pretty serious can happen, and that maybe we should aspire to that kind of transformation. But I do think that like in online, something happens that's very complicated where you have the freedom to pick who you're going to be. Like, am I going to be an anonymous troll today? Am I going to put like my social security number and my address, like on my LinkedIn profile and be a professional? You can be all of these things, but only at the expense of, first of all, being surveilled in every aspect of your life, leaving a data trail, you know, filling silos of information about yourself. And also just at the expense of feeling like very empty and very superficial in all of those identities. So I don't know. I think that whether we can transform or not is an open question. The movie is not conclusive on that point. But I do think that this contradiction is running through almost every arena of life right now. Be who you are and also be better than who you are. You know, stay in your lane and also see the world. There's this thing in the movie that people are going, see the world. We're going to see the world. At the same time, they're going, the world is full of freaks. We have to shelter in place. We have to stay away from the world. We have to avoid people. Mm-hmm. Those two tendencies, I think, at all times being felt by everyone. That's what I think is going on.
Absolutely. I think we're all feeling that. And I think, like what you said, like I think the virtual us moving increasingly online has in some ways pushed us toward that, because the internet does give us this anonymity and an ability to be whatever we want. And I think people are trying to find the ability to do that in real life. And it's a lot harder in a real space than a virtual space.
A lot more friction, a lot more friction in the
world. Yeah. I know we're coming up on the end of our time together, but I did want to ask you, because I think you do something very capital I important in this film, which is you reclaim the ability of LGBTQ plus characters to be awful on screen.
Oh, sure.
It feels like for so long, we had to deal with these sort of assimilationist politics and everything, you know, gay characters on screen to combat the, previous years of decades of us only being evil characters. They must be good and paragons of society. Do you also feel that way, I guess? Like, why do you feel it's important to take that back and reclaim that?
There are a few things. One is that I think a lot of the groundwork has already been laid by some very long-suffering people who are asserting, like, basically, like, no, we're not all deviants, we're not all wicked villains. Like, and that work, I think, was done in the 2010s. And basically, like, there were big strides made for in visibility that I don't think I would have been able to make. It's not in my nature. It's not something that I can dramatize as funny. The world of this movie, which is entirely, I don't think there's a straight person. I don't think there's a normal person in the movie. And so all of the tension actually just has to come from the fact that not only that these people are imperfect, highly flawed, but that they're not living lives of, so to speak, queer joy. Like, this is not a movie
about
queer joy and stuff. It's the
opposite.
This
is not an It Gets Better movie.
No. And because basically what I feel is that it's like, well, I think we're in a position where we can actually take a look at what that looks like and try and get catharsis rather than just dramatize and represent a happy outcome. Let's actually experience some catharsis about the aspects of queerness that are maybe not redeemable or like maybe not so joyous. But I don't know, that's too grand of a point. The real point is just that it's funnier this way. It makes me laugh more.
Well, it certainly made me laugh, and I hope it makes even more people laugh when they get to see it in theaters.
Well, thank you, Dan. It's a great pleasure talking to you today.
It was wonderful talking with you, Theta. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to Dan Baer's interviews with the star and producer for the film Stress Positions, John Early, and the film's director, writer, and star, Theta Hamill, here on the Next Best Picture podcast. Stress Positions is now playing select theaters from Neon. You have been listening to the Next Best Picture podcast. We are proud to be part of the Evergreen Podcast Network, and you can subscribe to us anywhere where you subscribe to podcasts. Be sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and let us know what you think of the show. We really appreciate your feedback and your support, which you can also lend on over at Patreon. For $1 minimum a month, you'll get some exclusive podcast content from us. Thank you all so much for listening, as always, and we will see you all next time.
Hello, this is Gary Chachot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.